Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Escape Maker, hosting the Women in Food and Farming Festival on May 8th and 9th. Learn more at womennourish.com.
This week on Meat & Three, we're celebrating the food culture of South Carolina with its chef ambassadors.
Oh, I'm super excited that it's soft shell crab season. Those little suckers are delicious.
People think, oh, tomato is a tomato. No, there is a good tomato and a bad tomato. So when they come to Hampton or even, you know, even in South Carolina, you can really find incredible ingredient.
We started getting lettuce from Micro Leon Farms in Conway. It's a super sweet family that runs that little farm.
Tune in to Meat & Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to HR and Happy Hour. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, and somewhere is Asheville, North Carolina for me. And what about you, Hannah?
I am in New Paltz, New York, and it is Happy Hour.
That is Hannah Forden, my co-host and HRN's program manager. I am Kat Johnson, HRN's communications director. We are your hosts today on HRN Happy Hour, and we're excited that you've joined us. We have some really fun events coming up that we're going to tell you about in just a moment, but I also want to introduce our guests of honor today on today's show. We have a returning guest on HRN Happy Hour, the one and only Bob Lewis. Real quick, let me tell you about Bob. He has dedicated his entire career to ensuring that millions of New Yorkers have access to healthy, fresh, and affordable food. He co-founded New York City's Green Market Farmers Market program in 1976, and since 2015, he's been advising the nonprofit Fulton Market Association, and they've been developing a farmer and producer-focused indoor and outdoor public market called none other than the Fulton Stall Market. Welcome, Bob.
Hey, great to be here.
We're so glad to have you back on. You have been on HR and Happy Hour before, back in the before times when we were in the studio, and so we've heard a little bit about your work, but we're excited to hear more today. Our second guest works closely with Bob as the president of the nonprofit Fulton Market Association. And we're going to hear a lot about how he and Bob met and started working together. And he is a first-time guest on our show. So big welcome to Stephen Dima. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you very much. That's a lovely introduction. I've not quite had one like that before.
We're super excited to talk to you both.
No one's been excited to talk to me for quite a while.
I don't believe it.
Well, it's our pleasure.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
We're super excited. So real quick, Pan and I want to share a couple of event announcements coming up. The first event is one that we are producing, and it's coming up very soon on Cinco de Mayo. Woo-hoo. We are hosting a virtual cocktail party, and we're teaming up with New York Times spirits writer Robert Simonson for a live experience. He has a new book out called Mezcal and Tequila Cocktails. I have a copy at my apartment. It's beautiful, colorful, and we've worked with him to put together a cocktail kit that has three recipes that you'll be able to make yourself for two people. And while you make them, you'll be able to tune into our event where he's going to talk to Souther Teague. We're going to have appearances from other hosts on HRN, from Agave Road Trip, from Cooking in Mexican from A to Z. So you'll get to hear more about this brand new book that just came out while you make cocktails from the book. So it's going to be a blast. It's a fundraiser for HRN. So you'll get to drink delicious cocktails, support the network, and hear from Robert. So definitely check that out. The tickets are at heritageradionetwork.org/agave. And then Hannah's going to tell you about how to make this event even more special.
Yes. So if you're feeling extra fancy and want to get a really special experience, we're offering a VIP version of this event that has some really excellent add-ons. So we're calling it, and there are only 10 tickets, so it's pretty exclusive, and I believe there are still a few left. So you can check out the Mezcal and Tequila Experience for Two, plus a VIP half-hour interactive tasting of La Luna's special Blue Weber Agave Spirit Tequilana, and you'll get some extra portions included in that special cocktail kit you'll be receiving. This tasting is going to be guided by agave spirit expert and host of our podcast, Agave Road Trips, Lubank and Chava Periban. It's going to be really, really fun. I can say from doing many happy hours with Lou and Chava that it is always a good time, and they know a lot about agave spirits. So you'll get to have that really intimate experience, guided tasting in the half hour before the event. And then you'll get everything that comes along with the event as well, including a copy of Robert's book From Books Are Magic and admission to the full virtual event. Plus, you'll be entered into a raffle to win a private tasting with the team from Agave Road Trip. And you can invite up to 8 people. So you'll get entered to win that. And since there are only 10 households participating, your chances are pretty good. So again, like I said, there's a limited number of these VIP tickets. They're going to be excellent. So be sure to check those out and book them as soon as you can. You can go to heritageradionetwork.org/agave, like Kat said, to buy your tickets. We hope to see you there.
Get them soon. One other event that I wanted to shout out is coming up a few days after our agave event. And it's sort of related to our guest today. Fulton Stall Market is partners with Escape Maker, who are dear friends of HRN. And they have a Women in Food and Farming Festival coming up on May 8th and 9th. That's a Saturday and Sunday. And in true sign of the times, this is going to be a hybrid in-person and virtual event. So some things will be in person up at Stone Ridge Orchard in the Hudson Valley of New York. And then there are also going to be elements of the event that will be accessible virtually. And one event within that I wanted to shout out was that we have an on-demand session featuring 3 HRN hosts of our agriculture and food policy shows, Jenna Liu, Lisa Held, and Katie Kiefer. And they've put together a sort of primer on how farmers can tell their stories to podcasts, publications, journalists, how to kind of figure out what's, you know, unique and newsworthy about your farm and about your story and how to pitch that. I think that's something that, you know, there's so many great stories out there. We're always on the lookout for them. But sometimes farmers, it's not like the highest priority thing for them. So we want to be able to kind of give them a few tools to be able to successfully pitch and not take up a whole lot of time to do it. So make sure if you're in farming or you work, you know, in food, farmers markets and in spaces adjacent to those, that you check out Escape Makers Women in Food and Farming Festival, May 8th and 9th, and that you can learn more at womennourish.com. That's womennourish.com. Okay. So many events coming up. It's really exciting.
Spring is here.
Yes. New York's coming back.
It is coming back. Yes.
Got to say that Stone Ridge Orchards is prominently represented at the Fulton Stall Market. I mean, all of our apples, the hard ciders, the sweet ciders, the apple chips, amazing. Her eggs and the baked goods made from the eggs on the farm, they are at the Fulton Stall Market. So yes, there is a connection.
we know Elizabeth Ryan for a very long time. As a matter of fact, we're with Escape Maker. There's a lot of events going on at the farm. It's beautiful there, 115-acre farm, apple orchard. It's gorgeous, and we have a number of events going on throughout the summer. One, if I may, I'm kind of excited about it. It's called Out with the Family on July 17th, and it's partnered with the Hudson Valley LGBTQ Center. And it's going to be a day-long family event celebrating family and community. And we have headlining that day, Amethyst Kia. She will close out that day. So I thought I'd be an you were going on about events. You got me excited. So I just you primed me to sort of to do a little promotion, if that's okay.
That's fantastic.
That's absolutely great. Yeah. Yeah, Hannah, that's all in your neighborhood. So you'll have lots to do.
My calendar is filling up, my goodness.
Which is great.
Yeah, it's been a little bit open recently. Yeah. I don't know about you guys.
Oh, God. Yeah, yeah. It'll be glorious to be on a farm doing an event.
Absolutely.
You know, it's interesting. You guys talked about, you know, helping farmers get greater visibility. That's really what this is all about. Before the green markets, really, the farmers were truly invisible and people mm-hmm. didn't know anything about local food. In fact, the term local food didn't exist, really. The whole idea of local kind of evolved, we think, from the farmers themselves making it possible to buy their products directly from them in the city. And visibility is so important, whether it's audibility here or visibility. This is what makes things happen. And honestly, this is why we're so proud to see the national growth of markets as it is. It's been truly a wonderful, one of the most wonderful things that we can think about in the last 20, 30 years that's happened in America. And so here in New York, we're just thrilled that, you know, we've had a role in that, as well as markets everywhere in California and in the South and all over this country. And so we're excited. We're really glad to be able to do something unique in Lower Manhattan, and not just only outdoors. And right now we're going to try to revive the outdoor market this year that was closed last year. But what we have is this unique indoor market that we want people to know is a viable model, especially now, to think about taking an empty space, a storefront in effect, and turning it into a basically daily indoor market run by a nonprofit with products from 100 farmers on consignment. Now that's a real community asset, and it really helps make those farmers visible. You add to that events, photographs, videos. It really helps people who are kind of locked down here take that leap into knowing who's out there and valuing them and understanding that they're making a difference when they buy locally, that they're supporting those families, and the result will be this healthy food that they're getting. Today in New York City right now at the market is Thursday. It's the pickup day for the Fulton Stall Market CSA, which has 80 families in Lower Manhattan, pretty much locked down for the most part, but looking at the market as their way of connecting with the farmers and the healthy food. And there are not just one option there. There are 18 different share options because we have the indoor space with coolers and refrigerators and shelves. We can offer people everything, not just veggies or fruit from Elizabeth Ryan, but fish from Long Island, Peconic Bay, Catskill meats, smoked trout from the Hudson Valley in Sullivan County. This is what you can do with a space like this.
Like a permanent brick and mortar space.
That's
yeah,
right. Exactly.
Yeah, Bob and Stephen, kind of for people who aren't familiar with Fulton Stall, kind of let's take a step back and just tell us how Fulton Stall Market started, how you guys met, and sort of how Fulton Stall is different from what people might think of when they think farmers market and it's a Saturday morning thing. This is different. Tell us about it.
So, well, the market started back in 2009. My wife had a background in food, and she had left her job at the time and had come to work with me at the Seaport. I had been there a number of years doing events and things. My dad, when I was a kid, had owned a restaurant on Ann Street, right in the neighborhood. So I kind of grew up going there on Sundays, and which is quite different than it is now. The powers that be sort of came to us and asked my wife if she would create the Fulton Stall Market at utilizing the old fish stalls right on South Street, you know, from the Fulton Fish Market. And as a matter of fact, Elizabeth Ryan again, she was one of the original, that's when we first met. She was one of the original farmers at the market, and that's when we met Bob. That's at the time, because he was working for the state and helped us navigate all that was necessary with the city and permitting and all these kinds of things on how to run a market, and so that's how that started. It was on Saturdays and Sundays, mostly on Sundays. It was an outdoor market, again utilizing the stalls. It was really wonderful, and My daughter learned to walk there. You know, she was the, when my wife was doing the market, there's pictures of her and her pack and play. And so she kind of grew up there on South Street, learning how to walk and how to ride a bike on Peck Slip. And so we've been very, very connected to the community and very connected to the Seaport in general, historically and personally. And so you fast forward a few years, Hurricane Sandy in 2012 wasn't very kind to the area, to say the least. And then in about a year later, the then speaker, Christine Quinn, the city had made an agreement with the Seaport to develop a 10,000 square foot multi-vendor fresh food market. And so Bob and I were all sort of reunited at City Hall that day. And one thing led to another. We had a space prior to the one that we have now where we started to really develop what was going on. And then that led to the space that we're in right now. And Bob, you can speak to what, how, I'd like you to kind of speak to why we are, what makes us truly unique and authentic.
Yeah, well, this is a really unique neighborhood in New York City, a historic district where the city's markets began. I mean, when we have kids come down in groups to do a program called Meet the Farmer, Meet the Farmer and the Chef and the Photographer. It's an interesting combination. You know, we talk to them about New York City history. And, of course, New York is a great port going back. Well, you can go way, way back. But, you know, the first colonies were in the 17th century. Henry Hudson and all that, the Dutch, which was interesting, New Amsterdam as a sort of a basis for New York City society, the trading post, and so on. The markets were established in this very district. And the city was lined with ships, and the ships needed to be unloaded, and they were unloaded, and stores were kept in these buildings. And this was the working port, of which there's a small remnant at the Seaport now, at the South Street Seaport Museum, a couple of ships there that harken back to those days. Well, this is a really important district, and it's been protected by New York City historic districting. That is to say, it's an old cityscape, you know, including a couple of buildings from late 1700s and then early 1800s. Anyway, you know, human scale neighborhood that's been protected from development. And so, you know, it's very important. I think we believe that people should know their past, their history, understand, you know, where they came from, and the stories that were going on at that point. We still have folks who know the old days of the Fulton Fish Market before it moved to the Bronx. And that's a whole story in itself, an amazing story. And it involves that name that we mentioned earlier to you, Sloppy Louie's Restaurant, and the New Yorker and the famous articles about Sloppy Louie's as the place for working class fish eating. Anyway, we're in that very building. The Fulton Stall Market is in that very place where Louis Marino ran his restaurant, had the freshest fish. This was the working waterfront. And so part of the market's goal is to retain that flavor, maybe that aroma, to remind people of the real thing, food, and connect with the producers of that food. So, you know, we're motivated by that, and we want to see a revival of it. You know, perhaps a larger facility that was promised in that agreement that Christine Quinn was the speaker of the city council then. She's not running for mayor at this point. It's an interesting situation here, but she did run for mayor and tried to take it to another level. She herself is a working class person. Anyway, she believed in markets and what they do for the community. She was really supportive of all of the city's markets, and especially how they could be connected with families in need using the wireless EBT systems we developed. I had a role in that, I should say. Anyway, she inspired this thought that there should be a permanent revival of the public market space at the Seaport. Other persons had pushed for that in the past. The New Amsterdam market was here for a while that championed this. And so we're holding on to that legacy. The market itself, if it evolves, it would be, in a sense, what we call a public market. It would have a public purpose. It would not only be farmers, but also producers of food who would combine in a multi-vendor space, just as outdoor markets are, but indoors. And I think folks who are listening are aware that around the United States and internationally, there are these remarkable places in Barcelona. It is a good one that come to mind, a whole city built on markets, but certainly in Seattle, in New Orleans, in Cincinnati, in St. Louis. These are old public markets, which are really part of that era where food and food vendors were given or provided a place that they could connect directly with the public. We're not talking here about a food court. We're not talking about food that's from anywhere without any real acknowledgement of who produced it. We're talking about a place where you can buy food, you can talk to the producer, just like an outdoor market, where you could learn, take courses, you could taste the food because value added would be there. The producer can make a sandwich out of that product. And stepping up, that gives the producer an extra source of income. Some people may know, the Reading Terminal Market in Philly. Others may think of the public markets in Boston or in Baltimore or in Washington, D.C., or actually in the South as well. I know you're in Asheville, Kat, I believe. And, of course, Asheville has an interesting story there, too, and is a wonderful place for agriculture and food. So anyway, this is what we're trying to see happen. And we want to see all these stories come back to life. The producer stories, the customer stories, those who have memories and who want to pass that along so that these stories can empower people to become producers or to cook better, to think about their ingredients, to be more, conscious of the environment. That's what a public market's about. It's about public purposes and helping the producer stay in business, encouraging new ones, and basically elevating our consciousness about healthy food and good food.
So, Bob, one of the things that I think is really special, Bob and Stephen, is really special about Fulton Stall Market is this little corner that you have there with information from Escape Maker that is sort of this connecting piece that shows people that come shopping in the South Street Seaport that they can go and see these farms themselves. They can travel up to the Hudson Valley. They can go see where their food's actually coming from. Why is that an important piece of the mission? And why is it important to have those resources in the Fulton Stall Market?
So very good point, and it's one of the missions. Farmers market can only do so much. It can't take the place of actual contact with an apple hanging from an apple tree. We all know the pleasure that family or kids have in picking an apple or actually digging a carrot out of the ground. I did when I was 8 years old at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. I think maybe that might have helped me want to do more of that sort of thing. Maybe I became a geologist because of that, or just being in touch with the earth and then later a planner. But I think that no child left inside idea, I believe in strongly, is part of the reason why we want to see people visit the farms and not just shop. I think that's essential. And of course, if we're going to get people to explore the idea of a rural life, and producing something, that is essential. So, we wanted to have a corner in the market for that. Call it whatever you want. In Italy, it's agriturismo. It's part of life in Italy. You go to the cheese farm, the dairy in the summer. You go to the winery. This is essential. I mean, and they've been culturally. We are still new in this. Agritourism, that sounds like a strange kind of word, kind of a portmanteau or something. I don't know, but it's essential. We also, during this pandemic, have been able to put farms online, you know, so the Full Install Market website, due to a little funding from USDA through Kalen and us, enabled us to create some sub web pages for each of the farms. So during this period, it sounds like that commercial about traveling in Scandinavia. But during this time, you know, it's possible to sort of virtually travel and click and discover a farm and see a video that the farmer made and maybe plan that trip that we're talking about now. But I think people are beginning to do that now. And so, for example, the Women in Farming Festival is a good example, good place to go and feel what it's like to be on that land and to meet Elizabeth Ryan and see what a Renaissance woman really is like. Yeah. In every respect. So anyway, there's a very important question. Thanks for asking it.
Yeah, it's important. The connection is incredibly important. You know, you talk about I wasn't as fortunate as Bob to pick carrots and things. I've told you this story before. I grew up in Brooklyn and we never really traveled upstate, and you know, we got apples from, you know, from the A&P, and it took me when I was 19 years old going all the way to England for a trip and ending up staying with a farmer in the north of England. I was fascinated. I couldn't. It was mind blowing to me, and it's mind blowing to think about it now. At 19 years old, it blew my mind that I could pick a piece of fruit from a tree and eat it, and it's something that I never ever forgot. And I have a 9-year-old and 11-year-old, and I think the thing that I'm grateful for the most is that they're surrounded by such great influence, people like Bob. My wife and her business partner own a shop in Brooklyn, and it's constantly being educated about food and food systems and where your food comes from and healthy food. And it sounds silly, but you know, I see other kids and I just feel really fortunate that. That I made that connection, because I could have gone through the rest of my life never having picked an apple from a tree. And it sounds ridiculous, but it's very true. And the other thing I wanted to say about Italy was just to go back, because I do think that a part of the market is for us is all the things that Bob mentioned, but it's also about preservation of things that are meaningful and soulful in life, especially in New York City. It's very, very important, and especially in the area, to have a market, whether it's 10,000 square feet or larger, you know, to have such a community space in a public market, the one that that is our mission as the nonprofit, that is the mission, is to have this space and to build this, will affect, you know, decades of people, not just in Lower Manhattan, not just the Seaport, but New York City in general. And we all know now more than ever, right? You know, we just see, I mean, there's nothing wrong with development. I've been watching it all my life, but there's definitely a part where we have to, you know, preserve those things that have true meaning in our lives. And obviously food is a no-brainer, you would think. And, you know, my daughter, as I mentioned, she was, you know, she's raised, you know, at the Seaport. My kids know it inside and out. I've, you know, my obsessions, that's what happens when you're a parent. But I don't know if you know, I'm sure you're familiar with who Jane Jacobs was, a very important person in the history of preservation in New York City, you know, fought Robert Moses. And you know, it's obviously we would have lost a few things like Chinatown or Soho. There's more to that story, but the Municipal Arts Society every year runs these Jane's Walk Tours. So my daughter is going to do a virtual walking tour of the Seaport on July 8th as part of the Jane's Walk. And, you know, it all starts with we'll start at the Fulton Stone Market. It all starts with the markets and the history of markets in the area. and it goes from there. And of course, Sloppy Louis will feature. It's a fascinating, incredible story. This Louis Marino came from Italy in 1905, and a couple of decades later, he came from a fishing village in Italy, and so he naturally fell in love with the seaport, and he opened up Sloppy Louis. He didn't want to call it Sloppy Louis. The guy before him, the restaurant was called Sloppy John's. He didn't want to call it that. And when the fishmongers found out that he didn't like it, of course, they called it, then they called it Sloppy Louis. And he finally gave in and just painted the sign. But, it was a place where the fishmongers would give Louis all their catch of the day, whatever it was. And it was really for their own benefit because he would make them whatever they wanted and try out new recipes and all this kind of stuff. So it was kind of a selfish thing on their part, but it grew to this beloved restaurant. And at one time, I think it had the largest seafood menu in New York, maybe beyond. But the other cool part of the story was he befriended Joseph Mitchell, who was a very famous writer for The New Yorker. And Joseph Mitchell wrote Up in the Old Hotel, which is a book of short stories. And the one short story about called Up in the Old Hotel is about how he and Louis became friends, and he would go to Sloppy Louis every day for breakfast. This is right there right on South Street, right where the Fulton Style Market is. And one day Joseph Mitchell talks him into going upstairs because Louis had never been up there. It's an incredible story. I won't go into all the details, but the fascinating thing is that when we talk about preservation and history and why these things are important, how it connects to food and stuff, that the old hotel, the old Fulton Ferry Hotel, was upstairs. This was built before the Brooklyn Bridge, so you get an idea of the timeline. And there are pieces that are still there as part of the South Street Seaport Museum. Right above us, there's an elevator shaft that Louis and Joseph Mitchell rode up in the early 50s. It was a manual, you pulled yourself up with a rope, which was kind of part of the story because Louis was afraid to go up there and Joseph Mitchell talked him into it. But but the history of the seaport is and food is really fascinating, really important to preserve these things. And we sort of promised you that we would tell the story of Sloppy Louis. And it closed. It was around for many, many years. His nephew, it closed in, believe it or not, it opened in 1930, I think, and closed in 1998, which is just mind-blowing to think about.
I think it's an interesting story because it kind of illustrates how all of these food kind of what we consider to be like different industries, like restaurants, farms, fishermen, like all these industries are actually really, really interconnected and survive without one another. And I kind of want to leave on that note to go to break, because when we come back, I want to talk about that. And in particular, how the pandemic in the past year has really illuminated that fact. So let's put a pin in that. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about sort of what the last year has been like for Fulton Stall Market and the community of farmers that you work with. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Escape Maker, hosting the Women in Food and Farming Festival. This Mother's Day weekend, May 8th and 9th, EscapeMaker.com will present the first annual Women in Food and Farming Festival at Stone Ridge Orchard in New York's Hudson Valley. That's just 2 hours outside of New York City in Ulster County. The two-day hybrid live and virtual event, open to the public, will honor and celebrate women-owned businesses in the food, farm, and craft beverage spaces and provide entrepreneur resources. A live farmers market on May 8th will host dozens of women farmers and craft beverage and food producers, with products ranging from cakes and cookies to fresh veggies and honey to hot sauces and teas, all locally sourced and produced. For those not able to attend in person, there will be a virtual experience on May 9th. It will include 25 online tours, demos, and educational presentations on various topics on demand for the public and trade. Learn more at womennourish.com.
Welcome back to HR and Happy Hour. I'm here with my co-host, Hannah, and we are joined by two guests today from the great borough of Manhattan. We have Bob Lewis and Stephen Dima, who have worked together for many years on the Fulton Stall Market, which is in South Street Seaport. And we were just chatting a bit about the legend of Sloppy Louie's, as I'm now going to call it, and just the significance of that restaurant to the neighborhood. And it really, Stephen, as you're talking about, made me think about the ways that all of these, different sort of food industries are so connected and reliant on one another. And Bob, you and I had talked with Kaylin Sanders from Escape Maker just about a year ago as the pandemic was really starting. And we were having a conversation around trying to support farmers as we were going into, you know, the really busy growing season. And the fear was that the pandemic would make people a little bit hesitant to go to farmers markets. There was a lot of unknowns at that time. And then, of course, restaurants were shutting down. And, you know, I think that on one hand, we saw CSAs pick up and people really did seek out their local farms in a really kind of surprising and great way. But then we also had a lot of hardships in the industry. And when restaurants closed, that had a domino effect on purveyors and farmers. So that all to say, like, how has the past year been for Fulton Stall Market and for all of the different producers and farmers that you work with?
Well, this has been an enormous shock to all of us. And if you're in Lower Manhattan, where 9/11 happened, there was a shock of you can't say equal significance, but of a different order back then in 01 that led to enormous transformation of Lower Manhattan. There's an irony in all this. Lower Manhattan, in effect, evacuated the financial district. We even had the Fulton Fish Market evacuating, after that in 2005, moved to the Bronx for reasons that were long in progress, having to do with trucking access and so on, and improved sanitation for the fish and so on. Because remember, this was an ancient market, 130 years old, operating on the street. But Lower Manhattan went through such a shock. What happened is the revival of residential in Lower Manhattan through incentives. So what you have is, in effect, the return to the residential neighborhood that it was when it was founded as the beginnings of New York City in the Dutch Village, of all things. And the irony, of course, with the pandemic is people stayed at home if they couldn't leave. So you have both an exodus from Lower Manhattan of people who moved totally out of the city. You have people who hunkered down in high-rise buildings and ordered in. And you have an influx of people who find that Lower Manhattan's actually almost like a village. And it was, with the curving streets, a village back in the Dutch era compared to the rest of Manhattan with its big, long grid, which was imposed on the city in 1811. We've had an interesting experience. The CSA that we started back in 2017 has actually grown because people do want to lock in their local food if they can and it's convenient. The folks who ordered for on their way home to Brooklyn or elsewhere, New Jersey, from their offices, well, those folks disappeared because they were no longer commuting to Manhattan, but they were replaced by more locals who wanted to do this. The place, you know, like New York City as a whole, you know, initially felt like a ghost town back then, certainly a year ago. And we maintained the store, running 6 days a week, believe it or not. And we instituted all the protocols, which were, still in place now, naturally, the masking and so on. New York being a mask-friendly place, everybody cooperating. So we managed to get through this. What we've done for the farmers who are part of the market, the CSA farmers, it's been very helpful to them. Elizabeth Ryan has said that repeatedly. to maintain and even grow the market through the CSA. If they're the fruit share farmer or the veggie share farmer, it's been very helpful to them. We did close our outdoor market because, frankly, the tourists in Lower Manhattan totally disappeared. Most New York tourists disappeared. It's beginning to rebound. Day trippers who took the ferries to visit Lower Manhattan, they pretty much disappeared. So really, we couldn't really run an outdoor market like we'd run on the weekend to serve those folks. And let's face it, it was an unusual kind of outdoor market, not the conventional farmer's market, because it was less produce and more specialty items, more startups, a lot of women entrepreneurs whose products are in the store now. But we couldn't run that. So we did stop that. We did maintain the storefront, the indoor market with products on the shelves and coolers. The CSA ramped up. We really had to stop the workshops that we were doing with schools and families, cooking classes and so on, obviously. Those are all in person. It was wonderful to do that, teaching kids to cook with their parents and vice versa. And the visiting of classes to meet farmers and look at the murals around the seaport. We have a wonderful series of murals of full-scale black and white photographs of organic farmers of the Hudson Valley from the book Organic Farmers and Chefs of the Hudson Valley by Francesco Mastaglia. I really suggest folks look that up. It's out of print, but we still have copies. It's a marvelous coffee table book, you want to call it, but it has essays for each of those 100 farmers about why they're organic, as well as the chefs. And so that photographer, we couldn't do those workshops with the kids, but, you know, working with Kaylin, that's why we wrote this little grant to get some funds so that we could do some of this stuff online, which is actually why we're online today talking with you and being able to kind of contain this, maintain it, I should say, and keep up these connections is what we wanted to do. We also just did our work to try to promote the safety of outdoor markets. Outdoor markets, in fact, were always the safest place to shop from the beginning, from last March. And the trouble right now is just that with the commercial district declines because of business, lack of office workers in many parts of Manhattan, the markets that were in those business districts, including at the World Trade Center, which I was the founder of in 1984, working with the state government and the Port Authority, that market just can't operate if there aren't office workers around. So it's the residential markets that are successful now, including the Fulton Stall Market. And all I can say is if you have an indoor location and it's winter, it certainly helps. Hence the idea of a storefront market, a nonprofit, a public market with more space. I mean, that's a big deal to be able to create a revival of that around the country, whether it's small or large, would be a really amazing step that we could take on behalf of farmers everywhere. And I love to try out new things and explore to see whether they can be replicated. And I believe this can be. It takes a community that cares, a storefront that's available, free or inexpensive, a nonprofit, community group or other who sympathizes with the idea. But it takes more than just a once a week operation. This is a full-time job. And I never, ever thought in my life as a geologist, a planner, that I'd be running with Steve and my colleagues on the nonprofit board, a real store. I mean, and then adding all these components. Never thought I'd be doing that. So now I know what it's like.
Well, we know a thing or two about nonprofits, and it's not, you know, not the same type of nonprofit, but I do know that there's always something more to be done. Like, the work is absolutely never done.
Yeah, and everyone finds their way there circuitously, I think, is sort of a beautiful thing about the food industry is it'll draw you in no matter what you think you're going to do with your life.
And it has, and we have hired, we have a wonderful staff of about seven folks, women, and who are in the food business. They're either, they were budding chefs or already chefs or entrepreneurs, and you know, we're supporting them, and then their motivation carries on in the way they speak with CSA members. Right now, I could say at this very moment today, there's folks coming in and talking with them about, you know, and they're finding their product for them, you know, whether it's the fish share or the smoked share from the Catskills or the cheese share, and they're talking about it and they're motivated. This isn't just like a store and where unfortunately the staff may not be motivated. It's almost like the market, the farmer's market, where the farmer, of course, is motivated because it's her product or his product. Mm-hmm. So that's why we love this and we want to, you know, see it grow.
And we can't forget our lovely chef, Bob, who lives on the Waver Tree, who comes over every morning and bakes and cooks all kinds of delicious things. Paul Doerr.
And I would say he is lovely. I mean, you know, this is a mariner from Maine who ran a series of small restaurants on the coast of Maine and, you know, with his tattooed arms and his bow tie, he's dapper when he wants to be and sort of grizzled when he wants to be and kind of sometimes very, very poetic and sometimes very taciturn. Turning out, getting up in the middle of the night, coming is the shortest commute. He comes down the gangway of the Waver Tree. He's a full-time employee of the Seaport Museum, but in this part-time life of waking up in the night and baking over at the Fulton Stall Market, he has added a very special aspect, to what we're doing. And he's not an employee. You know, this is like a farmer with the products being on consignment. So we've sort of accrued a wonderful array of folks who are sharing their talents and enthusiasm. And he's one of two chefs. We have a second chef, a woman.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts of when we visited the market was his food was really, really great. I really enjoyed it.
Real comfort food.
Yes, definitely. Well, my last question for the two of you before we run out of time today, I mean, this has just really flown by, is, you know, what do you envision is like, you know, as we come through this recovery time period from the pandemic, but looking forward, you know, 5-10 years, what's your hope and vision for both the Fulton Stall Market and then what, you know, other cities or neighborhoods could do to kind of build their own similar, you know, brick and mortar public market?
Well, look, we're seeing, you know, new federal initiatives on infrastructure, at least the words. We're seeing an important awareness of food access, hunger, anti-poverty strategies. You know, I've spent my years with the state ag department, you know, trying to, in a sense, create equity and encourage folks who one way or another have not had an access to anything, whether it's a school garden to get kids engaged really early on, or it's the, you know, use of the food stamp program, the SNAP program at markets and extra incentives like in the New York City Health Bucks program, where you get a 40% bonus if you use EBT. Those are things that we, you know, on the level of legislation, that's important food policy issues, and that's just sort of urban-rural connections. Well, infrastructure is a big deal. Nutrition and nutrition programs is also a big deal. They go together. I think, you know, I would like to see, and I'm familiar with efforts around the country, a lot of efforts have to happen locally. You couldn't have things happen unless a village or a town or a county or a city understands the value of public markets or farmers markets or both. They have to say, okay, there has to be legislation that makes that legal. We did that in New York a long time ago. It's not private use of public space. It's public use when you have a farmers market. Those things have to be in place. There have to be, you know, state interest in this urban-rural link. That has to include incubation facilities for entrepreneurs in cities, women and minorities in particular, quote unquote minorities. This is very important that we're doing this at the Fulton Stall Market, where those products can be showcased at the market. So there's this umbrella of sort of policy that needs to occur. I mean, that's why we really connect with FarmAid. We're really involved and volunteer at FarmAid every year. And they're not the only organization we care about nationally. There's a lot of organizations working on this sort of thing. We care about the watershed and what happens in the Catskill region, because the city gets its water from there, and food and water are in a sense the same. They're same essential, as essential as each other. Food shed is no different from a watershed in that it's an essential item that cities have to think about. So all of these policy issues need to be in place, and we need people to initiate these kinds of things locally and then in their state government. And then, of course, if there's federal legislation that enables things to occur, like the WIC Farmers Market Program or the Senior Farmers Market Program, these support markets wherever those markets are, so long as the state takes an interest in that program, that has to be advocated. So on that level, you know, we care. I think, you know, some of this infrastructure is critical. We would love to see a refocusing of cities on what I would say are public markets, the public interest in public markets, so that whether it's an outdoor market where public space is revived, just the way the restaurants are reviving in New York City through the use of the streets, it's very important, whether it's bike paths connecting to markets or schools and markets. You know, there's no way we can have this interaction with urban and rural unless cities say that's an essential part of their future. The idea of sustainable city, you know, it doesn't exist unless you have a regional awareness and an actual practical ways that the farmers can feel they can make it in the city. That's what happened at Green Market and back in Berkeley back in the day, when the farmers were invited in and they appreciated that. So that's the thing. As far as the full install market, yeah, if we ultimately could find that 10,000 square feet that was promised by the city council back in the day, that was included in the land use obligation for the revival of the seaport, that would be wonderful. If it doesn't have to be a public domain, it could be a private sector initiative. If you look around the country, there can be public-private partnerships. If you look at the ferry terminal in San Francisco, you see that there is that experience. There's the farmers, and then there is the public market. You can coexist. The restaurants can be there, and the farmers can as well. So I'd say, you know, it takes a sort of corporate social responsibility awareness thing here. If the business community and the financial community understands these values, if they want to be green, so to speak, there is a deep way of being green here that can send a signal to rural America that cities are their friends, that we can have this partnership and that we don't have to have any antagonism or adversarial stereotyping going on. There shouldn't be. We know that the handshakes are there. The goodwill is there. The farmers, we don't talk politics here. We talk about healthy food and community and yes, we want to see progressive things for sure that support families, support healthy environment and all of that. And I think everybody can agree that that's a universal need. So what do we want? We would like to see the real estate community recognize the importance of public markets. This is New York, the real estate capital. If that happens and everyone sees the value in that, everyone can, you know, really see a good future. The restaurants will come back. They'll be sourcing again from the farmers. This was a crisis and still is, for sure. So we need those restaurants to revive. And I think as people move back into cities, perhaps the way they did move back into downtown, we will see, you know, the outdoor markets thriving again. We'll see the restaurants thriving, and we'll see a mutual support system growing. No reason this can't happen.
Absolutely. Stephen, did you have anything to add there about kind of your hopes and vision for the future?
Oh, I just hope to be Bob Lewis when I grow up.
Don't we all?
I say that honestly.
Hey,
you know,
I hope to be Willie Nelson when I grow up.
Yeah. Ooh, even better. Yes,
these are all great goals.
Yes, Willie or Dolly—that's the goal.
Anyway, everything Bob said and more. I really feel that, you know, this is, it's all the folks that have come together so far with this have been such an amazing experience, a very special thing. And you know, it's just New York, I feel, is just very, very fortunate to have people that are watching its back, I think, in my view, you know, and not in a cocky way or anything like that, but just imagine, you know, if everything Bob said, you know, came true. Yeah, we're not adversarial to anyone, real estate or developers or whoever it is, but it is, I do wish that they would realize how great it would be for them and for everyone else. And then instead of the rush to keep building, whatever it is, I don't need to comment on it, but I just feel like something real and authentic that celebrates the history and celebrates, preserving the real heart and soul of a city is just so important. And lastly, I would just say that, I think if all that came true, it would be such an amazing thing for our city and its people.
Yeah. And I think to your point, like a wonderful blueprint. If New York can do it, it's a great blueprint for other cities. I think, you know, when food halls became the big thing, it's like every city then wanted to have a food hall. So like, why can't it be a public market?
Mm-hmm. And we're at the seaport, so ships can pull up too. You know, we even have the Apollonia is supposed to be sailing down from Hudson, New York, this summer to deliver some local brew. And some not only brew, but ingredients, malt, hops coming down the Hudson River like in the old days. They don't expect this to be the daily routine, but they want to highlight mm-hmm. that. And here we're at the seaport. We can unload it just like in the old days.
Yeah. What's old is new again. There's a great episode of Beer Sessions Radio that features the Apollonia and the work that they're doing. Oh. So I will try to find the episode number and put that in our show notes. That's a great connection there.
And we love Jimmy Carbone.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Bob and Steven, thank you so much for joining Hannah and me on Happy Hour today. It's been a real treat to catch up with you and hear about what's new and the future of the Fulton Stall Market.
Our pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I can't wait to visit soon.
That would be great. Thank you very much.
And thanks everyone for listening to HR and Happy Hour. Make sure you subscribe to never miss one of our episodes, and we'll be back soon with more conversations about the future of food here on HR and Happy Hour. Thanks. HR and Happy Hour is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.